You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
I can't see you very well, but I would like to ask, add a few questions to what Jean was asking already. I'd like to ask you, how many of you have done work with dying people? Okay. Since I will be talking about non-ordinary states, how many of you have experienced some powerful forms of non-ordinary states? I will not ask which way. And then more specifically, how many of you have had near-death experiences? Okay, that's quite a few. So the topic of this conference and the topic of my talk, obviously, you know, is one of the most important topics I can think about. There are very few topics that are so universal, so relevant for everybody. As Paul mentioned in his welcome address, the physical mortality still is 100%. So this is a topic that's relevant for everybody. We will all lose close friends, close relatives as we go through life. And then sooner or later, that issue will become very relevant for each of us personally. So in view of that situation, it's incredible that until, let's say, the 1960s, there was just absolute disinterest in the general population, but also among professionals of all disciplines in this particular area. And it's even more striking if we compare somehow the attitude towards death as we see it in the Western industrial world to the situation that existed in all ancient and pre-industrial societies, where death somehow was an extremely central, extremely important part of life. It was manifest in the cosmologies, in the mythologies, in the philosophies of this culture, in their ritual, spiritual life, and also very much in their daily life. And this becomes somehow particularly striking when we would compare a situation of a person dying in a Western industrial society with the situation of a dying person in ancient or pre-industrial societies. So the Western society is very much dominated by what has been called Cartesian-Newtonian materialistic science. That means the history of the universe is the history of developing matter. The only thing that really exists is matter. Life, consciousness, intelligence are somehow insignificant, accidental products of matter. And of course, in a situation like this, there's absolutely no space for spirituality and certainly no space for belief in survival of any kind. We have pathologized spirituality. From a strictly psychiatric point of view, when you are somehow interested in spirituality, when you're engaged in spiritual activities, it means lack of education. You really haven't caught up with what science has discovered about reality. It means you are superstitious. You are involved in what has been called primitive, magical thinking. And if you have actual experiences of the spiritual realms, that would make you a mentally ill person. We have vast literature in psychiatry, articles, books, just about every major founder of religion, about every saint, prophet, discussing what would be the best clinical diagnosis, what would be the category we would put them in. So obviously at the basis of all great religions were spiritual visionary experiences. You can think about the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and having the visionary experience of the visitation of Kamamara, the onslaught of his army, experience of enlightenment, and then at some later date, experience of a whole sequence of past lives, experience of tearing of karmic bond, experiencing karmic liberation, and so on. These are all psychotic experiences, according to traditional psychiatry. The experience of temptation in the desert, in the life of Jesus, all the communications with angels and gods that are described in the Bible, the experiences of the desert fathers. Muhammad had an experience of visitation of Archangel Gabriel, who took him through this miraculous journey through the seven heavens of Islam, and through paradise and through Gehenna. And he had a direct communication with Allah. He received these articles of Muslim faith and so on. This is all psychotic stuff, according to the tradition in which I was educated. Saint John of the Cross was called hereditary degenerative. Saint Teresa of Avila got the diagnosis of hysterical psychosis. Anthropologists have been discussing whether shamans should be called ambulant psychotics, hysterics, or maybe epileptics, because they have seizure-like manifestations during both the shamanic crisis and also when they actually conduct ceremonies. There's even an article by Franz Alexander, who was a very prominent psychoanalyst and the founder of psychosomatic medicine. He wrote a paper on Buddhist meditation, which is called Buddhist Meditation as an Artificial Catatonia. So you cannot even meditate without getting somewhat nasty psychiatric label. So in the context of our culture, of the science that we have, consciousness is the product of the brain. It's an epiphenomenon that somehow results from the complexity of neurophysiological processes in the brain. And it's clear in this context that it's also dependent on the body. When the body dies, the brain dies, and that's the irrevocable final end of any kind of consciousness activity. Now, although we have people, certainly in our culture, that are religious, in many instances it's religiosity, not spirituality. It's not based on a personal experience. And much of our mainstream religion has really lost the connection to a vital spiritual source. So religion of this kind cannot outweigh science, which is very much communicated by all the media. We are sort of surrounded by that. And to various degrees, all of us are certainly brainwashed into this way of seeing. So spirituality would be a tremendous help to people who are dying. But we have much more religiosity or kind of scientistic perspective in our culture. And that certainly is not a help for a person who is facing death. Now again, until recently, this particular worldview contributed to the fact that no interest was paid to near-death experiences. And there was no interest in people who were dying. We are achievement-oriented society. People who are dying will not contribute anymore. And for a variety of other reasons, there was simply no interest in dying people, in providing any kind of significant help, and not even in the experiences that people were having. And even today, where we have pioneering work in thanatology and things like near-death experiences would be dealt with in the media, this still has not really penetrated deeply into the medical profession to the point that professionals would somehow draw practical conclusions that would change the medical practices and the approach to dying people. The other thing that we have lost is significant human support. Much of the terminal care is really relegated to gadgets that sometimes reach the level of science fiction. All the life support systems frequently used beyond any kind of reasonable limit, and at the same time there is really minimal human support. And also families have to a great extent disintegrated in the West. We have situations where children live in Hawaii and parents live on the East Coast. We have also, in the kind of denial of death, we have removed sick people, dying people, so that we don't have to experience the discomfort that comes from that contact. So this is a situation of a person dying in a Western society, still to a great extent. Now, if we compare this with the situation in ancient and pre-industrial cultures, we get a very different picture. As I mentioned before, these cultures had cosmologies, they had philosophies, they had mythologies, according to which consciousness and existence would not end with the biological demise. In other words, life, existence, consciousness, in some form, continues after we die. The tremendous interest in the experience of dying, and a systematic tendency to map somehow what we can call the territories of the funeral geography. In other words, to describe the experiences that accompany death and that follow death. This could be described either as travels through some archetypal realms, the kind of landscapes of the posthumous realm, or sometimes in quite sophisticated forms as actually sequences of non-ordinary states of consciousness that we pass through, all the way to such sophisticated descriptions as the Bardo Tedel, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Now, in these cultures, we also find that there is effective human support. I mean, people live in the context of extended family, in the context of a clan, of a tribe. So when they are dying, they are surrounded by people whom they intimately know. They are assisted by these people, and they frequently have very meaningful rituals that are somehow marking this very significant transition. Now, what is particularly important is that these cultures have had actually contexts for practicing dying, or experiential training for dying, and I will say a few words about that. The first of these contexts would be very ancient. This is the shamanism that is very closely connected to death and dying, and also to non-ordinary states, in two very significant ways. The first one is that in many instances the career of a shaman begins with a spontaneous episode of a non-ordinary state of consciousness, which has been referred to as the shamanic illness with our Western academic bias. It should be called shamanic crisis, which is a state that either starts absolutely spontaneously without any known trigger, or sometimes when the organism is weakened. So, for example, in the Siberian and the Eskimo shamans, sometimes smallpox or some other disease could be a trigger, the last straw that precipitates that kind of experience. It's a powerful visionary experience in which the shaman would have a sense of traveling into the underworld, being attacked by demons, being put through various fantastic ordeals, tortured in some sense, deprived of being dismembered, deprived of muscles, the eyes taken out, and so on, experiencing a total personal annihilation, and then afterwards having a sense of being reborn, sort of being resurrected, being put together in a new way, getting new flesh, new eyes, new blood, and then experiencing a magic journey, a journey into the celestial realms, sometimes identifying with a solar bird, with an eagle or a thunderbird and so on, flying into the sun or into the cosmic source of light, sometimes being carried by a bird, sometimes climbing on a world tree, traveling on a rainbow, and so on. There are many different ways this can happen. But it's a very powerful death rebirth experience in a non-ordinary state. When they learn a lot about different levels of reality, about forces of nature, about animals, about origin of diseases, and they get insights about how various disorders should be healed. And then typically they start shamanizing when they integrate successfully this particular episode. And then the second aspect of shamanism is that the practice, the shamanic practice itself, always involves non-ordinary states. The shaman enters a non-ordinary state, the client might be put into a non-ordinary state, or both of them, or sometimes it's a whole tribe that enters healing shamanic ceremonies, like the Kalahari Bushmen, for example, in Africa. Another context in which the pre-industrial cultures practice dying are the so-called rites of passage, which are very powerful rituals enacted at the time of some important biological transitions, birth, circumcision, puberty, marriage, change in life, aging, dying, and so on, or movement of the tribe to another location. When we study what happens in non-ordinary states, the initiates would be temporarily separated from the body of the tribe, and they would be put through a very powerful procedure that typically involves non-ordinary states of consciousness. This could be caused by fasting, sleep deprivation, dancing, drumming, sometimes some physical procedures like bloodletting or physical pain and so on. In some cultures, actually use of psychedelic plants. And when we study now what happens during these procedures, these initiates would have powerful experiences of psychological death and rebirth. And in the context of the rites of passage, this would be interpreted as dying in the old role and being born into the new one. So in a puberty rite, you die as a girl or a boy, and you are born as an adult. And beyond that point, nobody dares to treat you as a child, unlike in our culture. You can be 60 and still be, you know, a little girl or a little boy for your parents. Generally, although there's deep similarity between the shamanic process and the process in the rites of passage, the rites of passage are generally considered to be a lower form of initiation because they are kind of organized by the tribe, whereas the shamanic calling is a higher calling. Something chooses the person for the shamanic career. Now, the third important institution is the institution of the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, which existed independently in many cultures. So the best known are the Middle Eastern mysteries, Isis, Osiris in Egypt, Attis, Adonis, the Bacchanalia, the Dionysian rites, and particularly the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. These were all based on mythologies that somehow discussed death and rebirth. There are typical deities, Osiris, Attis, Adonis, or Persephone, who was abducted into the underworld and then sort of seasonally returned. Inanna's descend into the underworld in Sumer, and so on. These were powerful mythologies of death and rebirth on which these mysteries were based. Somehow there were procedures involving non-ordinary states in which the initiates would identify actually with these prototypical archetypal figures. There's a wonderful study on the Eleusinian mysteries called The Road to Eleusis. It's co-authored by Albert Hofmann, who is the discoverer of LSD, Gordon Wasson, who brought the magic mushrooms from Mexico to Europe, and then Ruck, who is a Greek scholar. And they basically try to show that the Eleusinian mysteries were actually a psychedelic cult, that what was being used there was an ergot preparation, the sacred beverage kikeon that was administered there was an ergot preparation very close to LSD. These mysteries were conducted every 5 years for 2,000 years in almost 2,000 years in ancient Greece. And Aristotle, Plato, both wrote extensively about these mysteries. The term catharsis comes from this context. Alcibiades, Euripides, and some other very famous figures in Greece, they were all initiates of these mysteries. Now, the way we understand it now, what was happening in these mysteries was again offering us a context for a powerful experience of psychological death and rebirth, powerful experiential encounter with death that frees people from the fear of death, very much like near-death experiences that occur spontaneously. And as a result of it, they transform the way of being in the world in a very characteristic way. So these are the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth. They existed in other parts of the world. For example, the mysteries of Wotan in the Nordic literature, the mysteries of Xibalba, which were based on the story of the hero twins from the Popol Vuh, who went into the underworld and they contested the underworld lords in a ball game, and they emerged. They died and they were reborn and emerged victorious. There are also texts in many of these cultures that are known as books of the dead. These are very interesting because they were initially misunderstood as, you know, simply fairy tales that have absolutely no basis. When the scholars started studying them deeper, they found out that these were not texts that were referring to real death, but that they somehow served as manuals for these mysteries, that were sort of somehow describing what people experience in the context of some spiritual procedures, of some spiritual practice. What's described in Bardo Tödöl, according to the Tibetans, applies not only to death, but also to something that you can experience in deep spiritual practice, and something that, in a sense, is symbolic of what's happening all the time. The Pertem Hru, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, was used as a text underlying the Isis-Osiris mysteries and so on. And I already mentioned the Xibalba mysteries in relation to Popol Vuh. So the second version was, you know, these were not really just fabrications, fairy tale nonsense, but there was some kind of procedure that we don't quite understand, and this was a manual that was used for these procedures, and the priesthood has somehow hidden the true meaning of these texts by cloaking it into this idea of the posthumous journey of the soul. This was in some sense, to confuse the lay persons. Now, when we started doing consciousness research, particularly with psychedelics, but that some non-drug techniques, and also when the thanatological reports came, it became obvious that these two areas are really not mutually exclusive, that what these initiates were experiencing in these mysteries or in the spiritual context are actually, in a sense, operating in the same territory, which has been referred to as bardo territory. So in some sense, we can experience the realm, the experiential realm of dying on our terms during our life. And so the so-called books of the dead really can cover both of those situations because they describe the same territory. Now, the interesting thing is that, as you can see, in all these situations, non-ordinary states of consciousness are the common denominator. They play an extremely important role. And I believe myself now that the single most important reason for the difference between the attitude of ancient and pre-industrial cultures to issues like spirituality, immortality, and so on, is based on the differences in the attitude to non-ordinary states. That if you look at the ancient and industrial cultures, they held non-ordinary states in a very high esteem. And they spend a lot of time and energy developing techniques to induce these states. And I mentioned some of them, the fasting, the sleep deprivation, the dancing, the drumming, some of the physical procedures, psychedelic plans, or very sophisticated forms of spiritual practice, as it is in the East, particularly in the Eastern countries. They use these non-ordinary states for a variety of purposes. First, as a major vehicle for their ritual and spiritual life. In non-ordinary states, you connect to other levels of reality. You connect with deities. You connect with forces of nature, with the animal realm, and so on. You also connect in a different way with each other. Victor Turner, who's an anthropologist, wrote about this and said that people who experience non-ordinary states together tend to develop a sense of communitas, of community. There's a deep bonding, and we actually see it today, for example, in the holotropic breathwork, that people who do who have these experiences together very quickly develop deep bonding. They use these non-ordinary states for diagnosing diseases, for healing diseases, for cultivating intuition, extrasensory perception, for artistic inspiration, and also for some practical, pragmatic purposes, like finding lost persons or lost objects, or following the movement of game that they hunted, and so on. Now, this is an attitude that stands in very sharp contrast to the Western culture, where we have basically pathologized every single form of a non-ordinary state of consciousness, with the exception of dreams. If they are not recurrent, and if they are not sort of nightmares associated with anxiety, we have more tolerance. But every other form of a non-ordinary state is pathologized. We don't have... until recently we didn't have any distinction in psychiatry between a mystical state, a spiritual experience, and a psychotic experience. Anybody who would have an episode of a non-ordinary state of consciousness would be seen as being sick in one way or another. The reason why I said until recently, we now have in the DSM-4 a new category. I don't know how it's going to be used, what the consequences will be, but we have a category of psycho-spiritual and psycho-religious problems for the first time. We will see what will be done with it, including what the insurance companies will do. So I believe, you see, that the difference between our attitude towards spirituality and survival is so profoundly different from the ancient and the pre-industrial cultures, not because of our intellectual superiority, because we have a higher understanding of reality that was generated by Western science. But the reason is our very profound ignorance and naivete as a culture and as a profession in relation to non-ordinary states. It's an unbelievable thing, if you think about it, that nothing that's coming from the study of non-ordinary states of consciousness has ever been integrated into the conceptual framework of Western psychology and psychiatry. Now, whether this comes from the spiritual tradition of humanity, where we pathologize everything that has happened in the spiritual history of humanity, whether this is coming from comparative religion, whether it's coming from anthropological field studies, or from various areas of modern consciousness research. What was observed and experienced in psychedelic states was never taken into consideration by mainstream psychiatry. What we observe in near-death situations has never been taken into consideration. The fact that there is an disembodied possibility of complex perception of the environment, not only in the place where the body is, but also in different remote locations, has never been sort of seriously taken into consideration. We can understand why it is, because this cannot be handled by some kind of minor ad hoc patching of our current worldview. This would be a major overhaul. I mean, we would have to admit that everything that we believed about ourselves, about consciousness, about the relationship between consciousness and matter, consciousness and the brain, has to be, you know, very radically devised. This would be very painful, particularly for people who have made their careers on lecturing about the old way of looking at things. So what I would like to do now is, since, you know, my major interest for the last 36 years has been study of non-ordinary states, to address somehow specifically the problem of survival, which is the topic of this conference. What are some of the observations from the study of non-ordinary states that have direct bearing on the problem of survival? I would say the first and probably the most important aspect of this work has indirect bearing on the problem of survival, in that it generates enormous amount of data which represent a serious challenge. And if it were, you know, really considered, I believe it would be a mortal challenge to what has been called the Cartesian Newtonian materialistic worldview. Because in non-ordinary states you experience and observe things that should in principle not be happening if our way of looking at the world and ourselves is accurate. So what are, just very in a nutshell, what are those observations? In non-ordinary states, there is one large category of experiences that we now call transpersonal, in which you would transcend the ordinary limitations of your body ego and also transcend linear time and three-dimensional space and linear causality. Those are experiences when you suddenly can have an experience of your identity sort of leaking out of the context of your skin-encapsulated ego, as Alan Watts called it, and suddenly you're becoming something else or somebody else. You can become totally identified with another person. You can experience a consciousness of a group of persons. You can have a sense that you became all of humanity. In many instances, people become animals on different levels of the Darwinian pedigree. Authentic experience of becoming a lion, becoming an eagle, becoming a turtle or a cobra. It is also possible to have a very convincing experience of becoming elements of plant life, from plankton to a sequoia tree, and even inorganic aspects of the universe. For example, suddenly you have the feeling that you became consciousness of the ocean, you became consciousness of a granite mountain, you became an exploding volcano, and so on. So that in these experiences, everything that in the usual state of consciousness can be experienced as an object, in a non-ordinary state has a corresponding subjective state, as if everything in the universe exists in both of those forms, which is very similar to what you find in the Eastern spiritual philosophies, where the whole universe, everything, is a transformation of Brahma. Everything is a transformation of the Tao. There is nothing but consciousness. You know, reality, our realities are created by technology of cosmic consciousness as virtual realities. It is possible also to experience the past, either as such or with a sense of personal remembering in the form of past life experiences. So up to this point, we have had a definition of human beings as being Newtonian objects made of molecules, cells, tissues, organs, the image of biological thinking machines, image of highly developed animals, where consciousness somehow is seen as the product of the brain. And we have suddenly a category of experiences that are showing something very different, that in non-ordinary states we are much better described as infinite fields of consciousness that transcend time, that transcend space, that transcend linear causality. So we suddenly are arriving at a new paradoxical image of what it is to be a human being, which has a kind of a strange, distant echo of what the physicists found on the subatomic level, which is the wave-particle paradox, paradoxicality. If you want to describe what subatomic matter is, what light is, you have to say we are dealing with something that has the nature of particles, but also the nature of waves. These are two complementary aspects of the same phenomenon, the way Niels Bohr described it. And which aspect we will see depends on the circumstances in physics, on the arrangement of the experiment. Now, what I'm doing here is not extrapolating from subatomic physics to humans. This would be, you know, jumping too many levels. But what I'm trying to say is that through our own means, observing humans in certain situations, we are now arriving at a similar paradoxical definition. To really fully describe what it is to be a human being, we have to admit our paradoxical nature, that in certain situations it seems appropriate to think about ourselves as material objects, but in some other situations we have this quality of this field of consciousness that are unbounded, that are without any limits.